Hi, friends, and welcome to, I think I'll call it Fright Night Friday. This is your first bonus episode in October, and since this month is spooky month, and actually it's extra spooky month because we have a Friday the 13th, a rare solar eclipse, a meteor shower, and a full moon right before Halloween, I wanted to cover a couple extra topics outside of our regular lineup, and hopefully it gets everyone a little bit more in the mood for the Halloween season. So if I were to tell you a story about a blood-drinking monster that hides from the sunlight and lurks around at night preying on innocent victims, I'm sure you'd know right away what I was referring to, right? You got it. A vampire. Vampires are arguably one of the more well-known mythical creatures around the world that still seem to exist in some form in most cultures. And they're still used to this day in books, movies, and plays. But where did this legendary creature come from, and how has it changed over the years to form what we now know as a modern-day vampire? Well, tonight, we're going to find out, because this bonus episode is on the origins of the vampire. Even though legends of vampire-like creatures go back thousands of years, you might be surprised to find out that the version of the blood-sucking, night-dwelling beast we know today came almost exclusively from 18th century Europe, when writers began writing and publishing local tales and legends, and of course using their imagination to add intrigue and excitement to their stories. Some of the most influential being John Polidori's The Vampire, that's from 1819, and of course Bram Stoker's Dracula from 1897. But let's go back a bit further to where it all started. As mentioned, vampires have existed since ancient times, but it was predominantly in the form of demons and spirits. So to give a few examples, the ancient Greeks spoke of shape-shifting demons that would transform into young women and use their beauty to lure in men and feed off of their flesh. The ancient Romans believed in a night demon called the Strix, and I think that's how it's pronounced, who took the form of a bird. Sometimes it was depicted as an owl, and they would drink the blood of infants. In the first century AD, a Roman poet called Ovid wrote, "They fly by night and look for children without nurses, snatch them from their cradles, and defile their bodies." There were also tales of blood-sucking or flesh-eating demons in old Sanskrit folklore, and also Mesopotamia. It was even written in Homer's epic tale, The Odyssey, in 8th century BC, that certain spirits needed to drink the blood of humans in order to be able to communicate with the living. But it was actually with the Slavic people that the legend of the vampire truly thrived and would continue almost exclusively for the next 1,000 years and beyond, and would end up being the biggest influence of vampires we know today. The Upior in Slavic folklore is thought to go back as far as 4 AD. They were ghosts of the dead who would ultimately suck the blood or eat the flesh of their victims, who happened to most often be their family and close friends. Slavic folklore, specifically Polish folklore, had an entire range of Upior with different names and characteristics. The process for how people became vampires would seem very far-fetched to modern ears, but at the time, these were completely fathomable beliefs. They believed that you could become a vampire after death a couple of ways. So the first was if someone was to die outside of the region's accepted religion. So in other words, a heretic. They would then become a vampire after death. The second was if they were born with two souls. And the third was if they were the spawn of a witch or a werewolf. And I gotta say, on its own, that is a fantastic topic for another episode, so I won't get into the witches and werewolves just yet, but keep that in mind that the public had strong beliefs in those two creatures as well. The general thought at the time was that you could also tell who would become a vampire based on physical signs. So, for example, if a baby was born with any perceived abnormality, It could be as simple as being born with teeth, which we know happens, or having a unibrow. It would be suspected that they would turn into a vampire upon their death. Today, of course, we have a solid understanding of biological and genetic differences, but back hundreds and hundreds of years ago, they, of course, didn't. So these beliefs stayed fairly isolated within Slavic regions for centuries, but they wouldn't stay there for much longer, as the stories would slowly begin seeping their way through Western Europe. And so it was during the Middle Ages that the stories of vampires we now know first started really developing. And of course, we can't pinpoint a definitive timeline, but a few things happened that, when combined, caused the legend to take off. So first, let's talk about medical conditions. There were a few, but the one most likely that was the biggest influence was porphyria. Porphyria is a blood disorder that causes severe blisters on the skin when exposed to sunlight. And believe it or not, symptoms can be temporarily relieved by consuming blood. Now, animal blood is what doctors would have recommended, but you can see how it would be very easy for people just to hear blood and run with it, especially during such a superstitious era. In addition, the gums of those with this condition would often completely recede, so it would give the illusion of fangs when all of the teeth are exposed. And the icing on the cake? Aversion to garlic. That's right. The sulfur levels in garlic can cause porphyria flare-ups or an attack, causing a great amount of pain and discomfort. So it's really easy to see the connection between the symptoms of this disorder and characteristics of vampires in our classic tales. And again, this is just one disease out of hundreds and hundreds that would have had the same characteristics as supposedly being a vampire, so it's easy to see how imaginations could run wild, especially during this time. Then we bring in the plague. When the Black Death was ruthlessly spreading throughout Europe, there was a lot of fear and speculation. After all, it was completely decimating entire towns and it couldn't be stopped. Victims often suffered lesions and bleeding from the mouth, as well as coughing up blood. And of course, with so little medical knowledge, panic and paranoia began to spread again. And it was thought that vampires, or the undead, were feeding off of the bodies of plague victims, and that's how the disease was spreading. So anyone who passed from the plague and was suspected of being a vampire was buried with rocks or bricks stuffed into their mouths. And it wouldn't be the first time that vampires would be blamed for infectious diseases either. It happens again during outbreaks of tuberculosis and rabies too, just to name a couple. It was around this time that vampire hunters became increasingly popular, as during the 17th and 18th century, vampire attacks were supposedly on the rise. Vampire hunting wasn't as we think of it in fiction today, like Van Helsing or Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It looked more like townsfolk or religious leaders that would patrol villages looking for suspected vampires or listen to the accusations or complaints from other villagers while also exhuming bodies and performing rituals to ensure that those that were dead couldn't come back from the dead. Scholars and doctors really did try desperately to validate the rising number of alleged attacks by reviewing cases and assessing what was reputable and what wasn't. There was a biblical scholar named Augustine Camlet that published several texts on vampire lore and actually made a point of saying that some of the witnesses were just too detailed and reliable to dismiss outright, and that the mere existence of vampires had to be considered as a possibility. He said in his texts, "Many have seen the dead come back to earth, talk, walk, infest villages, ill-use both men and beasts, suck the blood of their near relations, destroy their health, and finally cause their death. These undead are called by the name of vampires." And it happened to be a pretty common thought that if a corpse didn't decompose as it normally would, that was a sure sign of them being a vampire. They simply weren't aware that there was a scientific explanation and that physical conditions can change how a body decomposes. Sometimes, after months or years, a body would still have flesh or flexible limbs or still even have liquid blood. We now know that bodies can remain preserved through many different ways, such as being buried in cold, damp environments. So with that, the lore continued to grow, and the stories and accounts passed from person to person, and then soon came the great vampire pandemic. So all across Europe, mass hysteria grew as vampires were blamed for outbreaks of rabies and pellagra. This led to the word vampire first showing in German texts as Der Vampir. And I don't know how it would be pronounced in German, but it's spelt D-E-R-V-A-M-P-Y-R. Vampire. I don't know if they would pronounce the Y as we do with an I. Anyway, that was around 1726. And then it was translated as vampire, V-A-M-P-I-R-E, in English by 1734. Pretty soon after that, the lore traveled overseas and soon hit North America. Enter Vampire Panic. Vampire Panic was a period of mass hysteria during a tuberculosis outbreak in New England in the 18th century. In both Europe and North America, when someone with a disease died, it was thought that they tried to consume the life of their family member or their friend, if they happened to catch it too. So to protect the villages, the bodies of those who had fallen ill had to be exhumed, and burial rituals had to be performed to prevent them from coming back. So they would often burn the lungs or other organs. They used iron nails or rods to pierce through the skull, like directly through the skull, through the brain, or through the heart. And they would then sometimes remove the head and dismember the rest of the body to obviously prevent the vampire from rising from the dead. They would then bury the remains in a very deep grave with the face facing into the ground so that it would bite into the earth if it was ever awoken. The end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century would see huge advancements in the medical and scientific community, and many explanations were now given for things that were once believed to be supernatural. So the general population's belief in vampires as a supernatural monster slowly diminished, and they were now used to entertain us and excite us in books, plays, and eventually movies. By this point, they were usually depicted as being sort of humanly, tall, thin, pale, sharp teeth, sharp nails, thanks largely to Stoker's novel Dracula. And then as the decades passed, they began to be depicted as even more human-like and even attractive, think Brad Pitt, rather than ghoulish, and even entire genres of movies or shows that featured good vampires were born. Enter Twilight. Even though science has proven supernatural vampires to be purely a thing of legend, you can still find real-life vampires in 2023. According to a survey by the Atlanta Vampire Alliance, there are at least 5,000 people in the USA alone that identify as real vampires. So these are people who claim to have a medical condition that requires them to consume blood in order to sustain themselves, be it either human or animal. They have donors that donate their blood to the community, and they follow a strict set of guidelines to ensure that their donors are willing and that the blood is collected ethically. And though their communities aren't large, they're very welcoming, and they share a common belief of challenging the negative stereotype that has surrounded vampires for thousands of years. One thing's for sure, the more understanding and knowledge we have of the world, the more we look for an escape, be it with books, movies, plays. So I have no doubt that the legend of the vampire has very successfully cemented itself as a permanent fixture in our imaginations for many, many generations to come. There you have it, a very brief history on the origins of the vampire. I hope you enjoyed this bonus episode. Have a great weekend, and I'll see you in a couple days for our Tuesday episode of Haunted History.